I will say, this was one of my favorite episodes. It will really withdraw you into it. No? Too bad, right? Draw you in? No?
The Curbsiders Podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital and its affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Internal Medicine Podcast, where we use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. Today, we are actually going to give Matt and Paul a break from recording, and we are going to bring you an episode from the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine Podcast, our mini-series on substance use disorder. So I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, and today I have two fabulous co-hosts, Dr. Sean Cohen and Dr. Zena Huxley-Riker. And on tonight's episodes, we are really going to dig in and dive in deep to the management of opioid withdrawal in the era of fentanyl with Dr. Ashish Takrar. But before we get too much into our content, Sean, will you remind everybody what we do on this mini-series?
I would love to, Carolyn. We are the addiction med podcast that uses expert interviews, often with people we idolize, and in this case, in someone who I've like read every paper that he's ever written and use it on rounds to justify what I'm doing. But we use those expert interviews with those people to demystify common addiction medicine topics, reduce stigma, and inspire listeners to become fierce advocates for everybody who uses substances that we're taking care of. And as a reminder, most of these episodes are available for CME through VCU Health CE for all health professionals by visiting curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And by listening to this episode and completing CME, this also counts towards the new DEA 8-hour requirement on substance use disorders education.
And this podcast would not be possible without the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. We are so grateful for their partnership and helping us make this season a possibility. So ACAM provides educational resources to help you deliver evidence-based care for patients with substance use disorders, strengthen your clinical practice with the ACAM didactic curriculum featuring expert-led sessions on managing substance use disorders in the real-world settings. So if you're looking for board prep tools or interested in testing your knowledge or your team's knowledge on key concepts, check out ACAM. Check out the ACAM question bank. Learn more at acam@acaam.org.
And tonight, we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Ashish Takrar, who is an internist, addiction medicine specialist, and clinician investigator at the University of Pennsylvania. His research focuses on opioid use disorder treatment in the era of fentanyl and other synthetic drugs. He works clinically as part of a hospital-based addiction consult team, and as an outpatient primary care and addiction physician. Ashish gives us the backbone for treating opioid withdrawal, beginning with either methadone or buprenorphine, adding on that alpha-2 agonist, using our appropriate symptom-based PRNs, and also how to use short-acting opioids to support the management of withdrawal.
And a reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And without further ado, let's get into learning about our guest. Okay, Ashish, this is the part where we're going to let our audience get to know you a little bit better. So do you mind giving us a one-liner to describe yourself?
Yeah, sure thing. I'm a 35-year-old man, husband, father to a 10-month-old baby who now has a Justin Bieber haircut, sometimes pianist, and occasional inline skater. Me, not the baby.
Yeah, I hope so.
But have baby skates for the baby?
Not yet. That might have to be a discussion.
Was a Justin Bieber haircut intentional or accidental?
That he just grew into, actually. And now we're at this point where we're debating whether or not it's haircut time.
I always like to ask, because I feel like the journey to kind of get how people get interested and got into addiction med is very unique. But are you up for sharing kind of how you wound up in the field and kind of what drew you to it?
Yeah, absolutely. My interest started in undergrad when a history professor, Carolyn Acker, invited me to spend some time at Prevention Point Pittsburgh, a certain service program. And I had never heard of a needle exchange before. Addiction care wasn't, or harm reduction was not something I'd heard about. It wasn't on my mind. And I just started volunteering there just because she thought it might be interesting, and it really was. And that's actually what kind of turned me towards wanting to go into medicine, was my time there, working with the people there. I think just the direct interaction and just working with people using drugs and the people helping provide services for them, I just loved it. And so that was my introduction. I kind of had a circuitous path during med school, wasn't sure what I wanted to go into, like many folks. And then during residency, I was in Baltimore, and there's a huge incidence of opioid addiction there. And where I was a resident, we were doing a lot of buprenorphine tapers. We weren't starting medication treatment a lot of the time. And I got to learn from the experts at Johns Hopkins Bayview while I was there, and kind of just see some of the gap between the care we were offering folks and the standard of care that they deserved. And I think, you know, between my experience in the harm reduction side and then just seeing how amazing it can be to actually provide the standard of care and quality care with dignity to people who use drugs, I just felt kind of in love with the field. And now I'm excited to be here.
Awesome.
I love how it started with like a history. Such a good advertisement for education, you know, like it's like random history teachers like, go check this out. And you're like, this changed my life now.
It's true. And I wanted to call her out by name because I don't know the full history, but I'm pretty sure she was really instrumental in getting certain service programs started in Pennsylvania.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's something I should go back and read more into and see if I can reach out to her.
Awesome. And on that note, Zena, do you mind just kicking us off and telling us about our patient case?
Yeah, of course. So Miss H is a 24-year-old who's admitted to the hospital for IV antibiotics for an arm abscess and now has a fever. She reports that she injects fentanyl daily, about 8 bags a day, and her last use was about 15 hours ago. She reports that she's thinking about leaving the hospital due to her opioid withdrawal and the pain in her arm. She appears uncomfortable with a runny nose and goosebumps. So I think she's considering this case. Curious to hear kind of what are the common symptoms of opioid withdrawal and like how you think about the onset and peak and duration of those symptoms.
Yeah, so this woman is pretty clearly experiencing opioid withdrawal from the history you just provided. I generally think of two major categories of symptoms for opioid withdrawal. One is the physiologic or objective signs that we can see on physical exam. Those would include pupil dilation, yawning, runny nose, watery eyes, heart rate that's elevated, blood pressure that's elevated, hair standing on end with some goosebumps, diaphoresis, vomiting, diarrhea, kind of the physiologic or objective signs. And then those are often paired with the psychologic or subjective signs that are patient reported: nausea, irritability, restlessness, anxiety, insomnia, muscle pain, bone pain, and opioid craving. And then you asked about onset and typical time course.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more research done about onset and time course for heroin or oxycodone, or even for the longer acting opioids like methadone, than there is for folks who are using fentanyl, which is the predominant opioid being used right now. So for heroin or oxycodone, we generally think of onset 6 to 12 hours from last use. And it tends to peak within that first day, maybe 18 to 24 hours after last use, and it tends to last about 3 to 4 days. Methadone, or really, you know, long-acting opioids, takes longer for a peak onset, normally about 2 to 3 half-lives for the onset of true withdrawal. But fentanyl is a little bit harder to predict, and that's because when used for short periods of time, it's a short-acting opioid. But for folks with opioid use disorder, they've been using it chronically. And so it just has different pharmacology, and not a lot of research has looked into the exact time course of fentanyl withdrawal, surprisingly little. But from what exists, it seems like onset is similar, about 6 to 12 hours from last use, but peak is actually a little bit later, 2 to 3 days from past use. And untreated, it can last 5-6 days. at least for that acute period of withdrawal.
And do you see a lot of patient variability in their presentation? Like, does everybody get the vomiting and nausea, or is it related to the timeline and the onset of symptoms?
It's such a great question. And there is a ton of variability in what signs or symptoms people can start with and then later on develop. I listed a lot of different symptoms. And yes, I was reading from the list because I didn't want to miss some of the biggest ones. It's a syndrome, right? And there are a lot of different symptoms, and people can show different ones at different time points. And so I do think it takes a little bit of, you know, thoughtfulness and consideration. I think those of us who are in this field and maybe have done fellowship training or a specialist, we've seen it enough and we have that end under our belt to kind of know it when we see it. But yeah, there can be different symptoms for different folks at different times.
I think, too, something that I'm curious on your perspective is I feel like a lot of people use multiple different types of drugs and how that can even make it challenging to say, what are you withdrawing from like right now at this moment in time?
That's really does make it really challenging. Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, I tend to think about certain physical exam findings as maybe being a little bit more indicative of withdrawal from certain substances. So, you know, I think pupillary response seems like it's a little bit more specific for opioids than for benzo withdrawal or alcohol withdrawal. That's one example. I think, you know, diarrhea, yawning, those seem to be a little bit more specific for opioids than benzo or alcohol withdrawal. I'm sure there are others. I don't know if Carolyn or Shania or Zena, you have any others that you think of?
I think those are the main ones that I kind of use to help differentiate for sure. But yeah, I think it can be really tricky when folks are using multiple things and you're kind of trying to track withdrawal syndromes across time during a hospitalization. Yeah. Do you have kind of a go-to measurement tool that you use to measure the severity of withdrawal?
Yeah, I tend to use the CAOS, the Clinical Opiate Withdrawal Scale. It's the one I was trained on. It's the one that I think is most commonly used in clinical settings and in research studies. So it has a constellation of different physical exam findings and subjective symptoms. And it's not a perfect scale. And I think within the field, there's been a lot of maybe critiquing it because this seems like there can be a lot of variability based on who's assessing the patient. But I still think it's kind of the go-to and the standard. And most folks you're talking to have a sense of what a CAOS of 5 means versus a CAOS of 15. So for communicating and for understanding where someone is on their trajectory, it's probably the best one to use right now.
So I feel like a lot of times I hear when I'm like talking with a team, or I think patients have heard a lot and I think get frustrated about is like, well, opioid withdrawal, it's like the flu, it's not that bad. It's not one of the life-threatening withdrawals. Do you have like, I mean, almost like maybe a teaching point or like something that you talk with residents about why we should care about it and treat it?
Yeah, opioid withdrawal is one of the main reasons why folks stay caught in the cycle of addiction, the fear of withdrawal, the experience of it. It can play a very large role in people's lives. I think anyone caring for a patient with an opioid addiction does care about helping that patient along their trajectory and probably cares about helping them achieve some sort of recovery if you know they have an addiction. So I think I try to sometimes connect it to the opioid addiction treatment part of it, that if we can treat their withdrawal, we can confidently communicate to patients that, hey, I can treat this and this will get better. That can be that first step to trusting the medical system and hopefully getting them on that path towards treatment. But that's not going to be the case for everyone. But we can at least treat the other issues that they're there in the hospital for if we can start with opioid withdrawal.
I like that framing a lot. I feel like sometimes it's like hard to get folks to like understand kind of that experience for patients. And I think that framing it in the setting of the use disorder is a really nice way of explaining that. I will steal that.
I mean, also with this case, this is a woman who's telling us she's about to leave, right?
Right.
You set up the case as someone who does need to be hospitalized and who does need medical care. And it's easy to flip towards blaming the patient or the condition if, you know, someone is leaving the hospital or not following what we think of as optimal medical advice. And so I also just try to harness that point. Say, actually, if we can treat her withdrawal, show her that that's a priority for us as well, then we can also treat the other parts of their medical care.
Yeah, I think such an important point, especially I think there's like good data that like people with substance use disorders don't have good experiences or often like person-centered experiences where they're having their needs met in the hospital. And so like seek medical care later. And I think research from you, not to tout you, although we will tout you a bunch, but like you've shown that like there are higher rates of premature discharges and like how much opioid withdrawal is playing in that, that have kind of trended up over the years as kind of fentanyl has become more prevalent and a bigger issue. And so, and we know premature discharge is associated with early mortality too. And so like all these things can link of like, if we address what the patient needs now and keep them in the hospital, like we can get them connected to treatment, but also like get their acute needs met and their infection treated and all that kind of stuff too. But
yeah, a woman like this has had a lot of experiences with medical care. I can just tell you based on the way, you know, you presented the case, and most of them have probably not met, you know, met her needs right away. So I think it's, you know, trying to build that rapport, build that relationship and show her that her priorities are shared. And she might be in a state of mind because of the withdrawal and because of her opioid addiction, where opioid withdrawal is the main priority she has. So let's, you know, inhabit that space with her. Let's try to share that. Let's try to focus on that first, while we keep in mind, yes, we need to work up the fever. We need to work up the abscess and treat that.
Yeah.
And I think, too, thinking about this case, say, you know, you get a page on her and the nurse asks you to come bedside and in the chart, you check beforehand that their COWS is 4. You go down bedside. And this question learners ask me a lot when they're actually doing the COWS score, right? As you said, there are two types of symptoms, like physical and more sort of subjective symptoms within the score. I'm curious if you have any recommendations or best practices for some of those more subjective things when you're doing the score. So for example, learners will ask me on the COWS score for bone or joint aches. You're often asked the patient whether they're having mild diffuse discomfort, severe comfort, or they're rubbing their muscles and joints and they can't sit still. So sometimes the patient will verbally say, I'm having really severe pain. And then the learner may say, but they look fine, so I'm not going to give them any points. How do you sort of think about how do you think about scoring some of those subjective things when you're chatting bedside with a patient?
I don't know if I have any great advice for that, except that you're pointing to some of the challenges with this withdrawal scale. It's one of dozens of withdrawal scales that exist. I think because of kind of historical accident in some ways, it became the major scale that's used. And I think the only advice I can give is I would just try to be as unbiased as I can when trying to frame the questions, because I have seen both ends of that spectrum. I've seen some folks do what you just described, which is minimize the symptoms and start from a place of distrust and say, unless I see what they're describing, I'm not going to believe it. And I've also seen the other end of the spectrum, which is people really overcall some things. And we'll talk about this with buprenorphine once we get to that part of the conversation. Overcalling it can also not serve patients well. And so I just try as much as I can to be as straightforward as I can and unbiased and just see what they say for the subjective questions.
That's helpful. And now that you're bedside, how are you going to talk to this patient? What are you going to do? What are your next steps to chatting with them?
I'm going to ask her how she's feeling. Just open-ended again. I think for the same reason I just said, I want to first hear what she says and what her priorities are and not assume it's the withdrawal, because sometimes it's not. But, you know, the way the case is set up, it sure sounds like it might be. And then when she describes how she's feeling, I guess your next question was, how am I going to frame the conversation with her? Was that it? I think I'm going to just, you know, if her biggest priority is withdrawal treatment, I'm going to say that is my biggest priority as well for you. And I'm going to do everything I can to aggressively and safely treat your withdrawal. And I'm going to make sure that we take care of your withdrawal and control it as soon as possible. And I mean it. And I'm going to back that up by coming back and visiting the patient again if I need to, because it's that important. If you're thinking about a woman with a fever, injecting drugs pretty regularly, lots of other risk factors for severe illness. So I'm just going to start by trying to just share whatever her priorities are. Just try to say, all right, I'm there with you. Let's make that happen.
Yeah. I love the shared goal. I also like pitch, like, and it sounds like you do this too, of like when you're first meeting someone and getting their priorities, like the history is very iterative to what is needed now. It's not like you're not getting her grandfather's history of hypertension right now, right? You're just getting like, what are the acute things you're going through? How do we make sure you feel better so you don't leave the hospital, kind of stuff?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I do want to know what substances you're using. At that exact moment, it might not matter as much, you know, the exact injection practices that you're using. I can come back and ask that later. You know, it's an important question overall, but not necessarily at that exact moment. So knowing that you have multiple chances, especially if you're checking back in with the patient.
And you also pointed out now is really important, I think, as well. I feel like half the time I'm already typing in my orders bedside to get the patient the meds while I'm in their room. It's not like a wait 4 hours until somebody sees my, you know, consultant note. So I'm curious, like in broad strokes, when you're thinking about medication options that you want to offer them like right now, what medications options do we have to manage her withdrawal in the hospital?
I'd say the foundation of opioid withdrawal management comes from a long-acting opioid that's going to be either methadone or buprenorphine, which have the best evidence. Then you're going to pair methadone or buprenorphine with an alpha-2 agonist, clonidine or lofexidine. You're going to use the host of non-opioid adjuvants that you have for a symptom-targeted treatment. And then any withdrawal you have despite those three, I would treat with short-acting opioids. That's my framework, is those four buckets, methadone or buprenorphine, an alpha-2 agonist, non-opioid adjuvants targeted to symptoms, and then, if needed, the short-acting opioids. So to answer your question, the first thing I'm thinking of is, are we going to start with buprenorphine or methadone as the kind of foundation of the withdrawal treatment for you, for this woman?
And how do you kind of frame that conversation and those options to the patient? Because I feel like it's one thing to like talk about that with the primary team and kind of like nursing team and all that kind of stuff, which I think is important. But I think oftentimes we kind of forget how to like explain that bucketing to the patients and to like empower them to like ask for things and like utilize PRNs and that kind of stuff. So I'm curious if you like kind of lay it out in exactly that same kind of four buckets that you just did for us, or if you have a different strategy of kind of explaining those options to patients.
I feel like that framework is a little bit too abstract maybe for what I would lead with, especially for a woman like this who's in active withdrawal. So I think I would start by saying the best medications I have to treat your withdrawal are either methadone or buprenorphine. Do you have a sense of if you might want to start one of those long-term when you're leaving the hospital? And that can help orient me to, you know, what is she thinking right now? Patients do not need to accept long-term OUD care to have their withdrawal treated. Let me say that up front. I want to emphasize that. You can absolutely treat their withdrawal even if they're not ready or interested in long-term OUD treatment. But knowing where she is and at least giving her the chance to explain that is an important first step. And, you know, if she says, I for sure want to be on buprenorphine, that has worked for me in the past, I want to start that right away, then I'm going to go in that direction. And if she says methadone, obviously I'd go in that direction. And if she's not sure, then it's going to depend a little bit on the context to see which way we would go. And I think when I'm having the conversation with her, I would just emphasize that we're using these for withdrawal. If you're not sure about which, you know, what you want to do long-term, that's okay. These are the best withdrawal meds we have. I probably wouldn't get into the clonidine and the adjuvants except to ask her what symptoms are bothering you the most. so I can make sure out of the non-opioid adjuvants, I choose the ones that are targets for the symptoms bothering her the most. And then depending on our approach to methadone or buprenorphine, that will also kind of determine whether and if we need short-acting opioids.
It's so tough to have these conversations because I feel like people are so uncomfortable. I have roughly 5 minutes to try and have a conversation that deserves like 30, you know, very easily. And the reality is for many parts of the country, methadone isn't an option for many patients. I live in an area that will serve a lot of patients who live in more rural areas, and it's just not an option. So just to review for people who maybe aren't familiar, methadone and buprenorphine in our country are two very different meds and have two very different modes of delivery. So methadone for OUD can only be delivered at an opioid treatment program, which not all parts of our country have access to, and you do have to go daily often for a period of time at many clinics, versus buprenorphine, which is a partial mu receptor agonist we can prescribe at a pharmacy so people can pick it up. So I find that in all honesty, sometimes that decision really pushes patients in one direction or another, unfortunately.
Just to build off of that, thanks for explaining that. I think for our audience, also important to note that those regulations are for the outpatient setting. And when, for this case, when we're in the hospital, there are different regulations that apply. And for methadone, it's considered administering medications for patients who are admitted to the hospital. So as long as someone is admitted for a condition other than their addiction specifically, in a very narrow sense, so if they're admitted medical condition, surgical condition, or other psychiatric condition, methadone can be administered in the hospital without dose or time limitations. But what you were saying is very relevant to the conversation of what does someone want after the hospital, of course.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing to just flag is like that choice, while it's helpful to have a sense of where someone might be wanting to go long term, it doesn't, like choosing one or the other at the beginning of someone's hospitalization doesn't mean that they can't make a different choice at the end of their hospitalization. It certainly can, there can be some more complications, but like in terms of switching between medications. But I think sometimes we are asking patients to make these really hard, bigger decisions about like what they want to be on long term in a moment where they're feeling terrible and can't really think forward like that. And so I think sometimes allowing the patient to like just make a decision that's going to make them feel better quickly is like also fine. And we can have that longer conversation later when they're feeling better.
Yeah. Love that. And I mean, just to add one more background thing, as our audience is mostly, hopefully, general medical people, is right, worth emphasizing how amazingly, if, like we talked about these meds as like the foundation for treatment of withdrawal, but they are crazy effective, right? I mean, reduce mortality for people with opioid use disorder by 30 to 50%, or maybe a little bit higher in some studies. Right, we don't have, other than like antibiotics, we almost have no medicine for chronic diseases that are that effective. Right, the number needed to treat to keep people in treatment is 2. Right, that's crazy. Like these are meds that we should be offering and starting, if people are interested in them, for every person with opioid use disorder, and particularly everyone that's hospitalized. And so, I'm a broken record with this, but I thought I would make it.
No, it's important to remind everyone.
Yeah,
and most of the patients that I'm seeing, I don't know if this is true at your hospitals, they have experience with these. They came into the hospital having a sense already of either like, I want one of them or I'm not sure. And so I don't want to put too much pressure on them, but also most of them have an idea and it's worth asking. And it doesn't have to be the most complicated thing. It's like, hey, do you want a methadone? Do you have an OTP? You know, the opioid treatment program. Do you have an OTP in mind or you've been to before? It's a yes and yes. It's like they know what that means. Great. Can be pretty straightforward.
Yeah, for sure.
So after this discussion, you actually learned she's been on buprenorphine in the past and did relatively well on it, but is really nervous to restart it because she reports the last time that she tried to restart it on her own, and she did. She tried to do this at home and made her really, really sick, like the worst sickness she's ever had. So she is just really nervous about this thought. And I hear patients tell me this all the time. So I'm curious if you could walk us through, like, what is buprenorphine precipitated withdrawal and why are we seeing more of it?
Yeah, great question. So buprenorphine is a partial mu opioid agonist, which means it has ceiling effects. It also binds with really tight affinity to that mu opioid receptor. So when you have a different opioid that's on the mu opioid receptor, and most other opioids are full agonists. So if you have a different opioid, it's a full agonist. Then you introduce buprenorphine. That buprenorphine is a bully. It'll kick off that other opioid and take someone from experiencing full opioid agonism to only partial opioid agonism. And that sudden shift from the full agonism, something like fentanyl or oxycodone, to just the partial agonism of buprenorphine, it can be experienced as sudden onset of withdrawal. And, you know, we use the term precipitated withdrawal or buprenorphine precipitated withdrawal when it's caused by buprenorphine. Then you asked about why there seem to be reports that it's happening more often with fentanyl. I want to start by saying this is an area where there's a lot of research and debate within the field. Patients are reporting that this is happening a lot more and are telling us that they're experiencing a lot more. In carefully controlled studies, the incidence of buprenorphine precipitated withdrawal is still very low, about 1%. But when you ask people how often they've experienced it, you know, about 30-35% of people with OUD and experience of buprenorphine say, oh yeah, I've experienced it. And when you ask them and you look, read the qualitative literature, a lot of them will say, yeah, it shifted as drug supply shifted from heroin to fentanyl. So we kind of have these two things going on at once, which is patients are telling us it's happening more often and they're experiencing it more. And in really carefully controlled studies, seems to be somewhat uncommon. And then when you look at real world studies, it seems to be more on the order of about 15% of the time in monitored settings. So the thought behind why this is happening is that fentanyl is very lipophilic. So it crosses cell membranes very fast, and it can accumulate in fat and skeletal muscle. And with chronic use, those accumulated stores of fentanyl can build up. And then even though you stop using fentanyl and 6 hours, 8 hours later, you do have some withdrawal, you still have some fentanyl leaching out of the adipose, leaching out of the muscle, and leading to there still being some fentanyl activity. So you can both have clinical withdrawal and some fentanyl activity at the receptor. There's a second part of this that I think is important to just mention, which is we sometimes think of the mu opioid receptor as just there and you either have an opioid in it or not. But there's a kind of second pathway to these receptors, and that's the beta arrestin pathway. This is getting a little bit technical, but I think it's important for this conversation because that pathway leads to those opioid receptors being internalized and less sensitive. And fentanyl is very active at that beta arrestin pathway. It's actually biased towards it. So what that means is fentanyl is particularly dangerous for precipitated withdrawal, we think, because it's both accumulated with slow terminal excretion, and it desensitizes and internalizes so many of those opioid receptors. So those two things, I think, is what sets it up. Now, a lot of this is still being worked out, but I think that's the best explanation for why right now.
I feel like I've never been before interested in someone describing what happened to receptors and beta arrestins. So I appreciate, I was genuinely interested. And I feel like I learned a lot because I haven't, other than the grand rounds I've heard you give, never heard of the beta arrestin stuff before. And it sounds like it is very important. So knowing kind of that kind of physiologic basis or that neurobiologic basis for this, like, do you have, like, how do you put that into practice on for someone using fentanyl? How do we start buprenorphine, but reduce the risk of precipitated opioid withdrawal?
Yeah, let's bring it back down to earth, right? This is an evolving area of clinical practice. So I want to start with a caveat that we are still, I think, figuring out the optimal way of starting buprenorphine in different settings. So I don't want to oversell one approach. And I wish I could just give you one single protocol that works across settings. Instead, what I recommend is thinking about this buprenorphine start based on the larger environment that the patient's in, the clinical context and then the patient itself. So kind of three levels. So you keep in mind the larger environment. Are you in a community where there seems to be a lot of risk of precipitated withdrawal or not? Because there are some places where it doesn't seem to be as much of a concern. Then there's the clinical context. Are you somewhere where you can wait a little bit longer and you have the luxury of time and you can treat people with other forms of opioid withdrawal treatment? And then there's a person in front of you. How nervous are they about it? And how sensitive are they to a little bit of, you know, of worsening withdrawal? Is it someone who, if it's a little bit worse, is going to walk out or not? So kind of once you have that kind of risk assessment in mind, I would say, you know, you can decide, do you want to do a traditional buprenorphine start or do you want to do something that has a little bit less evidence, but that's still emerging? And I would say most patients should probably still get a standard induction. And I would say that that is waiting at least 12 hours from less fentanyl use, wait for some physical exam signs of opioid withdrawal. And then once you have both those conditions met, I would start with 2 milligrams of buprenorphine, followed soon after by 2 more, followed soon after by 4 more. You could separate those by 1 to 2 hours. And I think with that approach, you quickly get to at least 8 milligrams of buprenorphine, which should be sufficient to get people out of the worst withdrawal. You can always give more. And you lower the risk of severe precipitated withdrawal by starting with slightly lower doses. I think if you're going to deviate from that standard induction, you can do that in one of a few ways. You can either do a low-dose induction with opioid continuation. You can do a high-dose induction where you just give someone 8, 16, 24 right away. Or you can bridge them with other opioid withdrawal meds like short-acting opioids and wait longer for fentanyl to clear.
That was so helpful, such a great breakdown of different ways to start buprenorphine. And I think as you pointed out, there's a lot of variability in our drug supply regionally. So I'm curious, like Sean and Zena, what have your experiences been starting buprenorphine to try and reduce the risk of precipitated withdrawal?
Yeah, I mean, I will say, like, again, I heard Ashish give the same talk for Grand Rounds and almost convinced me to do exactly what he does. But I also like my personal practice. And I think a lot of this is like based on the people you learn from, the place that you work is like, I often opt more towards either a high dose initiation. And so like, I think of high dose as honestly like a play on traditional of you're still waiting for withdrawal. You're still waiting for them to have objective signs of withdrawal, but you're just giving them that higher dose of bup up front. Just, and my always thought behind it is like, I get, and this is maybe hospital specific too, but like, I find that like, when I ask someone to get a big dose right away, they're definitely going to get it. And when I'm stacking meds, there's like too many variables that I worry that people aren't going to get the doses, then I'm going to leave them in withdrawal for longer. So it's more like a functional thing often, I think, than like that I know that this is going to prevent precipitated withdrawal. And I also lean a lot on low dose, using low dose which is like with overlapping full agonists. So it's like manage the withdrawal with some sort of full agonist. I actually rely a lot on methadone and then kind of low dose, gradual up titration of the buprenorphine and kind of sneak it into their system. I know we're not going to go like a ton into different regimens and stuff like that. We did do an episode in the Curbsiders Addiction Med. I don't remember the episode number.
Episode number 22, low rules for low dose bup. Pulling it up right now.
Yeah. Which has like all the apparently the low key pearls for low dose bup. So, but that's my personal practice. I lean more towards either high dose or low dose mostly. But
yeah, I think that's similar for me in New York as well. Yeah, I think similar to the way that I feel about management of alcohol withdrawal, where in an ideal world, we're using more symptom triggered benzos. But the reality of like staffing and a floor means that often for anybody that I'm sort of uncomfortable with, we're leaning more heavily on like scheduled dosing. I think similar to what Sean was saying about high dose, it just feels like in the ED setting where a nurse isn't going to be able to give another medication half an hour later, a high dose of bup is more likely to get someone comfortable faster. Yeah. Do I feel like it has any different rates of precipitated withdrawal or not than other mechanisms? I don't really know. But I think functionally that's definitely what I lean on. And I think similarly, even in the outpatient setting, I lean on that a little bit more than a traditional Bubestart just because I think for patients, it's a little easier to just take one dose and like be on it than try to like manage and titrate their medication at home by themselves when they're maybe not feeling great. But I don't know. Carolyn, what is your experience?
I mean, similar to all of yours, I think the hard part is we just don't understand enough. We don't really understand all of the risks of precipitated withdrawal. Other than that, it really is like pretty traumatic for patients. You know, like it is extraordinarily terrible to watch, extraordinarily terrible for like people to experience. Half the times I'll ask a patient, like, what dose do you want? Because I don't feel so strongly that either one is going to decrease the risk. I'll just say, what do you want? I can give you 8 milligrams. I could do 0.5. I have some patients who want the small doses frequently, and I'll do 0.5 every hour. And they know that it's not going to like immediately improve their withdrawal. And maybe I'll schedule some, you know, diazepam with it to just help with it. And some people say, I really just want to get on it. Just give me as big of a dose as you can. Just give me 16. And I am okay with like any of those options as long as they're willing to take it and try it, just because, as we all said, I don't think we really know for sure if any of these really reduce the risk. But if a patient is willing to try it, or if they've successfully gotten on it that way before, then I definitely want to use that method if it had worked for them in the past.
And I think, you know, what we're hearing is there are lots of different ways to do it. And just also for our listeners, I'd love to share, through research looking at what change in cows over what time matters to patients, there's, I think, a pretty good operational definition of precipitated withdrawal, which is a rise in the cow score of at least 6 within an hour. So that leaves actually quite a bit of room for a spectrum of severity. So what, Carolyn, what you said, I've certainly seen cases that is really traumatic, it's horrible, and it's very severe. And I think some people would say, oh, that's the only thing that's, quote, real precipitated withdrawal. But I think what we know from this research asking patients what matters to them is anything even less severe than that, all the way up to a rise in cows of 6 within an hour, is still, this is a medication that's supposed to be reinforcing, right? And if instead your cows is going up by 6 within an hour, you're going to not want to take this medication a lot more. And it's going to be kind of harder to convince someone to keep going with it. But I also want to just share with the audience, like, how long does this actually last, right? What happens after it? So I don't want the end of the story to be, okay, you have to try to prevent precipitated withdrawal or else, dun, dun, dun. You know, it might happen. And if it happens and you're in a hospital setting, you can treat it and you can kind of get patients through it. I think there are quite a bit, probably about a dozen case reports or cases described in case series about precipitated withdrawal. They all tend to only last a few hours, 3 to 5, 3 to 6 hours. That's with treatment even. So I think it's not something that lasts indefinitely. I think reassuring patients that we can treat it. Most expert guidance says just to give more buprenorphine. I have seen that sometimes help. I have seen that sometimes seem to do nothing. And I have occasionally seen it make things worse. So I think it is fair to try that. And I think I also would pair that with other comfort meds. I think this is a great time to use benzodiazepines, something like 10 milligrams of diazepam, 2 milligrams of lorazepam, something along those lines, something that's fast onset, benzodiazepine. And I think if you have access to ketamine, I think there's some early case reports suggesting, and you know, expert opinion suggesting that can really help. It also makes sense mechanistically to take it back to beta arrestin because, you know, ketamine's whole mechanism of action is that it repotentiates opioid receptors, right? So you're giving that buprenorphine that you already gave them, you know, somewhere to bind, so it can actually have an effect. Precipitated withdrawal, if it happens, I think can happen on a spectrum of severity. And if it happens, it's time limited and we can treat it, is just what I wanted to share.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
I really appreciate bringing the beta arrestin back. But I also like, I think it's, I do feel like there is this like sometimes this fatalism around it of like, but it's still an amazing medication. This is like, even if it is more common, it's still not a super common outcome and we can treat it, right? And so this being nervous about causing precipitated opioid withdrawal should not prevent you from starting bup as a life-saving med that can help somebody, right? And so
100%. I feel like we probably talk about it too much, and it's a real phenomenon that we need to figure out from the research side of it. And it matters to patients. So it's a tough balance to strike.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I really let the patient's concern for it drive my concern for it. And I don't really, like, I don't think the research has explained to us whether some people are more susceptible than others. But it, to me, it feels like that is true. Like, I feel like I just have patients that no matter how we do it, it lands in precipitated withdrawal. But also patients are really committed to wanting to get onto buprenorphine. And so they'll push through that.
And if we wanted to switch to maybe a slightly easier medication to start, such as methadone, you know, we did the hard-hitting one fast, the most complicated one. But Ashish, would you mind walking us through, if you're going to use methadone for this patient's withdrawal, regardless, like as you said, whether they're going to stay on it or not, but we can use this in the hospital, how would you choose the dose and titrate it within the first 24 to 48 hours?
I would start with 30 or 40 milligrams of methadone. If I'm involved as, you know, I work as an addiction consult provider, and if I'm involved, I feel very confident giving someone 40 milligrams of methadone in this situation. I think if you're have a little bit less experience with methadone, you're maybe not sure, or if you have any doubt about the history that was provided, then you can start with 30 milligrams and give 10 milligrams after that. But I think someone using fentanyl, if they have fentanyl dependence, can tolerate 40 milligrams of methadone, as long as there are not other major risk factors and for over-sedation, which there weren't in this case. So I would both be, you know, conscientious about methadone because it's a powerful medication with complex pharmacology, and confident. If someone's using fentanyl, they can generally tolerate 30 to 40 milligrams of methadone. And I'd start with that.
Do you offer any other PRNs? I often find that it's not enough if somebody has heavy fentanyl use and that people still get uncomfortable. Like they'll say, hey, it helps me for like a couple of hours. But then really by the time it's the evening, I'm already getting back into withdrawal, jumping on my skin, wanting to leave. How do you sort of manage that? Because you're to point, the pharmacology is complex. So it's a little bit more complicated to titrate that. But thinking about what do we do in those first 24 to 48 hours, anything else you do for them?
Yeah, I definitely want to give other withdrawal treatments in addition to methadone. If I can just give a short summary of pharmacology for the listeners of methadone. So it's generally given as an oral medication. It has onset of action in about an hour, peak effects about 3 to 4 hours after oral dosing, and a half-life of, on average, 24 hours. But there's a lot of variability. So what does that mean for this woman in front of you? If you give her methadone, she should start to feel some effects within an hour. Peak effects, 3 to 4 hours, and they'll start to wear off after that. And it's pretty common for people to say, oh yeah, my withdrawal has come back 8 hours, 10, 12 hours after the methadone dose. So let's preempt that and try to make sure there are other medications in place. So now I'm going to move to that second box after methadone or buprenorphine. I'm going to make sure there's an alpha-2 agonist that is being given. Clonidine or lofexidine are two options. Lofexidine is a lot less commonly used, but it's one of the only FDA approved medication specifically for the indication of opioid withdrawal. It's an alpha-2 agonist that has less blood pressure and heart rate effects than clonidine. So I'd give clonidine or lofexidine as long as their heart rate and blood pressure could tolerate it. Clonidine starting doses are typically 0.1 to 0.3 given every 8 hours or maybe every six. Those alpha-2 agonists work very well to treat opioid withdrawal. And I kind of think of them in a different category from the other adjuvants because there's such strong evidence for them to treat a host of withdrawal symptoms. Then you're going to make sure that the other, typically, you know, we call them the PRNs, are on board for her. So you want to target the specific symptoms she's feeling. And then most patients like this who are injecting high amounts of fentanyl, I'm going to also start a short-acting opioid as well. And I want to just explain a little bit of the rationale there. You know, some people might say, why wouldn't you give more methadone? And I think you need to balance the risk of dose stacking methadone on days 2 or 3 with trying to treat their withdrawal now. So if you gave, because methadone has such a long half-life, if you gave the same dose 3 days in a row, the effects on the body are going to actually dose stack over days 2, days 3, all the way up until day 5 to 6 when you get steady state. And so if you want to balance that risk, but aggressively treat the withdrawal today, you might feel like, oh, I can't go higher on the methadone because it's going to have dose stacking effects day two or day three. So you want to use some other meds. And that's where I would reach for short-acting opioids like hydromorphone or oxycodone.
And I think, too, a good point to bring up for our listeners is we're in the hospital setting here. So in the hospital, you can definitely use these short-acting agonists to help withdrawal, though you cannot do that outpatient. It is not legal to do that outpatient. So in the hospital, we can, but outpatient, you cannot. It's only for pain outpatient.
And if I can add one other thing to what I was saying, just how much methadone can you give on day one, right? How much is safe to give? This is another area where the evidence is shifting. And I think a lot depends on your environment and, you know, your confidence with using methadone. So I think for generalists, I would say it's safe to say 40 milligrams day one, 50 day two, 60 day three. I think as an addiction consult team or as addiction specialists, I have often gone higher, but I would probably reach out to expert pharmacists or consult service providers if you're a generalist and thinking about going higher than 40 day one, 50 day two, and 60 day three.
Yeah, and something that I sometimes think about, I think, again, kind of based on patient preference, but given that kind of pharmacology and pharmacokinetics that you were mentioning about the kind of like wearing off of that first dose of methadone, I will sometimes like give 30 with a 10 milligram PRN like later so that the patient has something to add on top of that 30 milligrams when maybe that dose is starting to decrease. I don't think it's the perfect solution. And I think that's where short-acting opioids come in and all these other adjuncts that we were just talking about. But I think sometimes that can be helpful for the patients to at least feel like there's something available to them if they need it later on.
And if you are going to use short-acting agonists, what dose do you start? And how are you giving it for like COWS greater than 8? How are you deciding to give the short-acting agonist on top of the methadone?
I'll typically start with hydromorphone, 8 milligrams, or oxycodone, 20 milligrams. Again, that's speaking as someone who's coming in as, you know, part of the addiction consult team. I think for generalists who maybe don't have as much experience, I think it might be, you might need to be more conservative and start hydromorphone 6 or oxycodone 15.
And just to clarify for everybody, these doses of hydromorphone are all oral dosing recommendations.
I have a slight preference for hydromorphone just because it has stronger binding affinity. So I think you get a little bit more effects, but that's probably more theoretical than anything. So I would start with, let's say, hydromorphone 8 milligrams or oxycodone 20. And then for the hydromorphone or oxycodone, I typically schedule these Q4 and add instructions to hold for sedation. I have tried many different iterations of the PRN order and none seem to actually get the job done. You know, what is a PRN indication for? What I wanted to say is, you know, PRN for severe opioid craving or subjective opioid withdrawal or acute pain, right? That's a lot of pressure to put on a nurse to assess, especially when you're using atypical doses. And I don't think it's fair, actually, sometimes to ask nurses to make that call when what we're doing is a little bit outside of, you know, what like the evidence-based standard is, because we haven't built it yet for fentanyl. So that's why my preference is to schedule it and then hold for sedation.
How do you, I mean, I will say like my practice is very similar, and I think when you're taking care of people and starting methadone or whatever you're doing when you're trying to treat the opioid withdrawal, like it's really hard to match the tolerance that fentanyl does. And so you kind of, I feel like it's a very rare situation now where I don't use short acting opioids in addition to kind of whatever our foundation is, whether it's methadone or bupe kind of, but how do you respond when you're like talking with a team and they're like, well, like giving short acting opioids, like, isn't that just worsening their addiction? This is something that comes up a lot. And so I assume some people will be thinking too, but like, isn't this worsening their addiction or feeding their addiction? Like, is this what we should be doing?
My first thought is I'm really happy that this person I'm talking to is, you know, being so thoughtful and cares so much about the person's overall trajectory. Like, quite honestly, I think that's a sign that they're thinking about what is the effects of these meds long term and not just in the moment, not just thinking, oh, what's going to make my job easier today in the moment. So I think it comes from a very good place. And I practice in a hospital where like the pendulum has swung all the way in the other direction. So I might need to remind myself of what the conversations were like when I practiced in a hospital when they were on that side of things. I think a lot of the time I'll try to remind folks that these are people who have been using short-acting opioids daily for months, often years, maybe decades, and 1 to 2 more days or a few more days of exposure to that is unlikely to significantly worsen what's already a severe addiction. And the potential upside is if you can adequately treat their withdrawal, treat the other medical conditions, work up her fever, give her antibiotics, and help her build trust with the medical system, you have the opportunity to actually help change that trajectory. So I don't want to be totally dismissive of that concern. I think you can get to that point if all you're doing is giving short-acting opioids and you have no other indication for her to be hospitalized, and you kind of can get caught up in that if that goes too far. But I think early on, when you're needing to treat their withdrawal, like that has to be the priority in order to take care of everything else. And I just think the potential downside of a few days of exposure to short-acting opioids, it's probably pretty minimal in the context of someone's life.
And I think too, it's hard, even with these doses, they sound high because they are higher than most opioid naive patients. But I think it's really just treating the withdrawal. I don't think a lot of patients are experiencing like euphoria or these other reinforcing effects. I think they're just trying to feel normal, just because fentanyl is so potent.
It's so important to remember that these doses are orders of magnitude lower than the MME that someone gets from using, you know, the fentanyl that's out on the street. So, yeah, I just keeping that context in mind is really important. I do think you have to be, you know, you have to keep your, you know, clinical, you know, mind aware, like, you know, who's a patient in front of you, and not be like too cavalier with them and just throw the same doses at every patient, you know, even the ones who might have, you know, advanced cirrhosis or kidney failure, or, you know, who are on oxygen at home and stage COPD, right? You have to still be thoughtful. It's not just a blind protocol you just throw at people. But like Sean said, I end up using these on most patients who are experiencing fentanyl withdrawal, because I feel like these doses of methadone are often just not enough.
And do you find that you're continuing to use these short-acting opiates, like if someone has like a week-long hospitalization, are your doses decreasing as they're like, as you're titrating their methadone, or are they kind of remaining on these short-acting opioids throughout their hospitalization?
My goal is to get them off of those short-acting opioids within about 48 to 72 hours if I'm using them for withdrawal management.
Right.
And that's the key distinction I try to make here. So if I'm using it for withdrawal management, I think, you know, treated opioid withdrawal syndrome should only last a few days. Untreated, it, you know, probably 4 to 5 days of acute withdrawal, but with treatment should only peak maybe 2 to 3 days after last fentanyl use, and then should be basically abated after 3 or 4 days. So my goal is to use those short-acting opioids to bridge the difference between the methadone that I'm getting them. And if I'm going aggressively and escalating my methadone, find that I can come down off my short-acting opioids pretty quickly if I'm just using them for opioid withdrawal.
Are you using short-acting opioids at all in conjunction with buprenorphine?
I am, and I'm using it in two different ways. So one way is to bridge people with short-acting opioids. So if this woman, in the case that we talked about, says, I know I want buprenorphine, we're in somewhere like where I am in Philadelphia, where there's a very high concern for precipitated withdrawal in the community, where a lot of patients have a lot of fear of it themselves and low tolerance, they'll tell us. And she says, I just, the biggest fear in the world I have, like, I can't do precipitated withdrawal. And I ask her, you know, how long have you had to wait in the past to start buprenorphine? Because most patients know. She says, I had to wait 48 hours. I'll say, okay, I'd probably use short-acting opioids as the only opioid agonist, bridge her with scheduled hydromorphone or oxycodone for 48 hours, and then hold that opioid for 10 hours before that end of the 48-hour period, and then just start buprenorphine after that. And that's a situation where I'm pretty agnostic about just doing 2 milligrams, 2 milligrams, 4, and then 8, like a standard induction, or just giving her 8 or 16 right away. I think either could work if, you know, you have 48-hour bridge from the last fentanyl use.
And you said there was a second situation.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I forgot about that. So that's... thanks, Sean. No, that's low-dose initiation with opioid continuation. So that's where I might be using short-acting opioids and with a plan to transition to buprenorphine using a low-dose initiation. If I'm doing that, then I will almost always use methadone also. And I'll just kind of have methadone as the backbone. I just won't escalate the methadone 40, 50, 60. I'll probably keep it at around 40 milligrams, maybe 50, just because in my experience, and I think there is some, you know, cohort studies with small n, but showing that higher doses of methadone, especially 80 or above, are sometimes harder to do the low dose transitions from. So I try to keep it below 60 if I can, if I know my goal is a low dose initiation.
And like, what do you do in the situation? So we talked about, I mean, and I really appreciate kind of the framework that you've given us for treating opioid withdrawal, the severity of it, kind of our backbone of methadone or buprenorphine, our kind of secondary but very important kind of alpha-2 agonists, our extra PRNs that are symptom-based, and then short-acting opioid agonists, which we talked about as being like more and more necessary at times. What do you do when somebody just says like, I'm not taking methadone, I'm not taking buprenorphine? Like, does that change your calculus? And one, or like, how do you have that conversation? Does that change your calculus in offering some other medication?
I'm pretty firm and insistent that we use methadone or buprenorphine as the backbone of withdrawal treatment with patients. And I try to dig a little bit deeper when if they have some hesitation about it and say, okay, you know, first off, why? Normally with buprenorphine, it's the fear of worsening withdrawal. So that I let that go. But the methadone part of it, I find that the concerns they have are often about continuing it long term. And I think there's a little bit of a confusion that they might have to say, oh, if we start methadone now, are they committing to continuing after the hospital? And I try to explore that and just reinforce for them that methadone is the best withdrawal medication that I have. I know the doses that work well. It has just such a just magic juju to it, you know? Like, I feel like I've talked to folks who haven't really used it, and then they start using it, and they're always like, wow, methadone is great. And I've talked to a lot of patients who've only been offered, like, oxycodone, withdrawal therapy, and then they get methadone, and they're like, whoa, this just feels so much better. So I just try to communicate that to them. It's really the best withdrawal med we have. And most of the time when we kind of have the conversation, I'm somewhat insistent that at least have methadone be part of it. They're like, all right, we'll try it. And I'll say, we'll do everything else also. We'll do the short-acting opioids, but like, let me use methadone. I'm also not going to force it, right? I want to push it a little bit and make sure I understand why they say no. But if they're really insistent, occasionally that happens. And patients will say, absolutely no, I'm really not interested in methadone. And like, I really, please do not give me any of it even while I'm here. And that's okay. They certainly retain autonomy, and we need to be very respectful of that. And that's when I will just use the other kind of three buckets.
Yeah, I appreciate also the framing around. I agree, there is this magic. I love magic juju. I'm going to use that from now on too. There's this magic juju about methadone is just so much more. It's so much more active, and it's such a more therapeutic, I think, for opioid withdrawal than you can really hit with just short-acting opioids or even like kind of long-acting versions of those, that it just, you get so much more bang for your buck. But also like the emphasis on like, this decision isn't a forever decision. This is a let's treat you now decision kind of thing. And so.
And I mean, I can tell you guys this, I won't go into this with patients, but as we're talking about this on a podcast, there is such robust evidence for methadone treatment of opioid withdrawal, right? We know it works so well. We know the doses that work. And yes, those were from a different era where the opioids being used were heroin or oxycodone, but doesn't mean we throw that whole evidence out. I think we just maybe adapted a little bit to fentanyl. So I just was so much more confident that it's going to treat withdrawal rather than some doses of oxycodone. I'm not sure. You know, if it's, yeah, it's hard to know sometimes.
So I think you just gave our audience a huge toolkit, really, of like what they can use for this patient. And I think that's helpful. Like, we have to deploy different tools in different situations, different contexts, different patients. So I think to summarize, as you said, methadone and buprenorphine, those are the backbones. You got to start there. But don't forget about the adjuncts. You can use alpha-2 agonists such as clonidine and lofexidine, as well as really tailoring those adjuncts as well. I think in my practice, I honestly often schedule them. I'll just schedule the anti-nausea medicine. I'll schedule the clonidine so that way a patient can say no rather than having to feel like they have to ask their nurse for it. And also that because of issues with fentanyl's potency, you can use short-acting agonists. And you described a number of ways we could use that on top of methadone to sort of supplement and help with the fact that fentanyl is just so potent and 30 milligrams may not be enough. Or we could use it as a way to just sort of wash out fentanyl by using oxy for 1 to 2 days or hydromorphone to give fentanyl a chance to sort of clear before starting buprenorphine. Is that a good summary? Is there anything else? Those are the big buckets.
That was fantastic. You said a lot clearer than I did.
Well, you taught us about all these things today. So I think, I just have one. We're getting late in the evening. I just have one more quick question for you. You know, I think we're hearing a lot more that the drug supply is really toxic. It is mixed with all sorts of things. I'm just curious, like, what other adulterants are we starting to see in our supply? I think you're probably seeing some more of them in Philly that hopefully it won't spread everywhere, but important, I think, for our listeners to be aware of.
Xylazine was a big one that entered the drug supply a few years ago, and by 2023 was in more than 90% of sampled opioid samples. They're called dope in Philly, fentanyl, they mostly are. And xylazine is an alpha-2 agonist. It's not FDA approved for use in humans. It's an animal used for veterinary medicine as a sedative, and seems to be associated with a particular kind of wound that can advance and become quite severe. There was a lot of concern about xylazine withdrawal when it emerged in Philadelphia, and a lot of people who use drugs described the withdrawal feeling different, more restlessness, more anxiety, lasting a little bit longer, more nausea. I don't think there's any evidence yet of a adrenergic hyperactivity response from xylazine withdrawal. So you're not seeing, by and large, lots of hypertension, tachycardia, not regularly requiring ICU care. So that's xylazine. Over the last 8 to 12 months, xylazine has fallen in the drug supply where we are, and metatomidine has increased quite a bit. Metatomidine is the racemic mixture of dexmedetomidine. And so that is another alpha-2 agonist, quite a bit more potent than xylazine. And we're not seeing as many wounds. This is just anecdotal. But what we are seeing is a much different and more severe withdrawal syndrome. We still don't know how often this is occurring. You know, we don't really know what the denominator is. So it's certainly not everyone, but there are more and more instances of people having severe nausea, vomiting, hypertension, tachycardia, and of course, tremor that seems to only be responding to dexmedetomidine infusions, which means they require an ICU. I was on parental leave when a lot of this emerged in Philadelphia. So I just want to shout out a lot of the colleagues in the emergency department in Philadelphia across the different health systems. And in Pittsburgh, they put out 2 studies on this in the CDC's MMWR. So folks can read more about that there. So summary, xylazine does seem to be associated with wounds. And subjectively, the withdrawal feels different, but not a lot of objective manifestations that we've seen. Metatomidine, we're not seeing the wounds as much, but some people exposed to metatomidine really do seem to have this profound adrenergic surge with severe nausea, vomiting, hypertension, tachycardia, and a tremor that doesn't respond to higher doses of opioids and seems to only respond to dexmedetomidine infusion.
It's terrifying, to be honest.
Yeah, it is really scary.
Yeah, less it we all need.
Well, I guess, I appreciate this was honestly very eye-opening, and I think like a great overview of both of opiate withdrawal and again like a good framework for how to treat it. What other take-home, or do you have any big take-home points you want all the listeners to kind of go home with?
Yeah, I would love for folks to strike a balance between not burying their head in the sand and like ignoring that the drug supply is different. It is different, right? What used to be oxycodone maybe or heroin is now fentanyl mixed often with different adulterants. So we need to be responsive to that And also the other extreme that I love people not to fall into is ignoring the decades of research and evidence behind what's the best way to treat opioid withdrawal syndrome, because I think that's still relevant. So taking what we know works, taking what has been built up as good medicine, and then adapting as we need to a changing drug supply. I hope we can kind of use that framework, because this is not the last shift in the drug supply. There's going to be more. And if we start with kind of evidence-based standard, then we know at least we've done this and we can see what is changing.
And is there anything you'd like to plug on this podcast? Could be anything, a resource, a TV show, whatever you think is important or that you care and love about.
One thing I'd love to plug is more community-based drug checking. So many of us are flying blind about what's actually in the drugs that people use. And that's a choice that we're making as a society about not putting more resources towards checking these things. And there are really great organizations. One of them is close to where I work and live, is Pennsylvania Groundhogs, where they do a lot of community-based drug checking, and they actually get quantitative reports for what proportion of each drug is in the supply, because it matters if something's just a trace amount or is 50% of the sample, right? Yeah. So, you know, some people might wonder, how can I know what's in the drug supply? If you're lucky enough to live in an area where there is more community-based drug checking, then try to, you know, tap into those resources. Most of them are putting out regular email blasts or on social media. And if you're not in an area with one of those, then maybe working with local advocates, harm reductionists, to see, you know, can you get something like that off the ground? Because people who use drugs would definitely benefit from that. And us as folks who take care of those folks also would.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Of course. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders mini-series, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/addiction. And hey, you know, if you're still hungry for more, join the Curbsiders Internal Medicine Patreon and get all episodes ad-free plus twice monthly bonus episodes at thepatreon.com/curbsiders. You can find show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get weekly show notes in your inbox.
We are committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So subscribe, rate, review the show on Apple Podcasts, or shoot us an email with some feedback at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. And a reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org.
A special thanks to ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more about their organization at acaam.org. And thank you to our writer and producer for this episode, Dr. Zena Huxley-Riker. Shout out to Pyle Roy for doing an incredible job reviewing this episode. And of course, Dr. Sean Cohen for being an excellent co-host, and our entire Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by the team at Podpace. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris, the True Manchu, moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed the theme music. And with all that, until next time, I am Dr. Carolyn Jan.
I'm Sean Cohen.
And I'm Zena Huxley-Riker. Thank you so much for joining us tonight and letting us bring you some addiction medicine pearls.